dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week I began playing you speakers from a three-day teach-in, Confronting the Global Triple Crisis, put on by the International Forum on Globalization, the IFG, last September. It's holiday programming, Unwelcome Guest style, bringing not, alas, tidings of comfort and joy, though I wish you that, but gifts nonetheless of knowledge and courage to meet what lies ahead. This week we'll continue with more speakers on the panel addressing Dimensions of the Global Triple Crisis, moderated by IFG founder Jerry Mander. The three presentations will be followed by audience discussion with some of the panelists heard this week and last. Then we'll wrap up the program with the conclusion of Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On, from the 2006 book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, which deals with many of the same themes from a different angle. Here's Jerry Mander introducing our next panelist.
I have the great pleasure to introduce my good friend Annie Leonard, who is the director of the Funders Working Group for Sustainable Consumption and Production. But for 18 years, Annie Leonard was famous worldwide, internationally, for her work on waste and sustainability campaigns internationally, and as the head of an organization called Gaia, which is Global Anti-Incinerator Alliance. She's also worked at Greenpeace, at the Greenpeace International Toxic Campaign. She's a great activist all over the country and all over the world. And she's going to introduce a film that was made about a presentation that she does, which has now been transferred to film. And although we want her to do that live, actually we also want to promote this film. So we're going to let her introduce it. Please welcome Annie Leonard.
So those of you in the audience who know me know that I love to talk about garbage, about stuff, about the materials piece of the triple crisis. Those of you who know me will also probably be shocked that I'm actually going to pass up the opportunity to talk live about garbage because I am so excited about this new film, The Story of Stuff. This film is just completed. It was completed about 3 days ago. It's going to be released next month, but I wanted to give you a sneak preview because it relates so much to the issues that we're going to be talking about this weekend. It will be on the web in October. So may I introduce The Story of Stuff.
Do you have one of these? I got a little obsessed with mine. In fact, I got a little obsessed with all my stuff. Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out? That is not the whole story. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine. No problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system, and we live on a finite planet. And you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. So let's go back through. Let's fill in some of the blanks and see what's missing. Well, one of the most important things that's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values that government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. Okay, so let's see what else is missing from this picture. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at U.S. rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world, which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. So next, the materials move to production. And what happens there is we use energy to mix toxic chemicals in with the natural resources to make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts, and none have been tested for synergistic health impacts. That means when they interact with all the other chemicals we're exposed to every day. So we don't know the full impact on health and the environment of all these toxic chemicals, but we do know one thing. Toxics in, toxics out. As long as we keep putting toxics into our industrial production systems, we're going to keep getting toxics in the stuff that we bring into our homes and workplaces and schools. And duh, our bodies. Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night. Now, these toxics build up the food chain and concentrate in our bodies. Do you know what is the food at the top of the food chain with the highest level of many toxic contaminants? Human breast milk. That means that we've reached a point where the smallest members of our societies, our babies, are getting the highest lifetime dose of toxic chemicals from breastfeeding from their mothers. Is that not an incredible violation? Breastfeeding must be the most fundamental human act of nurturing. It should be sacred and safe. Now, breastfeeding is still best, and mothers should definitely keep breastfeeding, but we should protect it. They should protect it. I thought they were looking out for us. And of course, the people who bear the biggest brunt of these toxic chemicals are the factory workers, many of whom are women of reproductive age. They're working with reproductive toxins, carcinogens, and more. Now, I ask you, what kind of woman of reproductive age would work in a job exposed to reproductive toxins except for a woman with no other option? And that's one of the beauties of this system. The erosion of local environments and economies here ensures a constant supply of people with no other option. Globally, 200,000 people a day are moving from environments that have sustained them for generations into cities, many to live in slums, looking for work, no matter how toxic that work may be. So you see, it's not just resources that are wasted along this system, but people too. Whole communities get wasted. Yep, toxics in, toxics out. A lot of the toxics leave the factories in products, but even more leave as byproducts or pollution. And it's a lot of pollution. In the U.S., our industry admits to releasing over 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year. And it's probably a lot more, because that's only what they admit. So that's another limit, because yuck, who wants to look at and smell 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year? So what do? Move the dirty factories overseas, pollute someone else's land. But surprise, a lot of that pollution is coming right back at us, carried by wind currents. So what happens after all these natural resources are turned into products? Well, it moves here for distribution. Now, distribution means selling all the toxic contaminated junk as quickly as possible. The goal here is to keep the prices down, keep the people buying, and keep the inventory moving. How do they keep the prices down? Well, they don't pay the store workers very much, and they skimp on health insurance every time they can. It's all about externalizing the costs. What that means is that the real costs of making stuff aren't captured in the price. In other words, we aren't paying for the stuff we buy. I was thinking about this the other day. I was walking to work and I wanted to listen to the news, so I popped into a Radio Shack to buy a radio. I found this cute little green radio for $4.99. I was standing there in line to buy this thing, and I was thinking, how could $4.99 possibly capture the cost of making this radio and getting it into my hands? The metal was probably mined in South Africa. The petroleum was probably drilled in Iraq. The plastics were probably produced in China. And maybe the whole thing was assembled by some 15-year-old in a maquiador in Mexico. $4.99 wouldn't even pay the rent for the shelf space it occupied until I came along, let alone part of the staff guy's salary who helped me pick it out, or the multiple ocean cruises and truck rides pieces of this radio went on. That's how I realized I didn't pay for the radio. So who did pay? Well, these people paid with the loss of their natural resource space. These people paid with the loss of their clean air, with increasing asthma and cancer rates. Kids in the Congo paid with their future. 30% of the kids in the Congo now have dropped out of school to mine coltan, a metal we need for our cheap and disposable electronics. These people even paid by having to cover their own health insurance. All along this system, people pitched in so I could get this radio for $4.99, and none of these contributions are recorded in any accounts book. That's what I mean by the company owners externalize the true cost of production. And that brings us to the golden arrow of consumption. This is the heart of the system, the engine that drives it. It is so important that protecting this arrow has become the top priority for both of these guys. That's why after 9/11, when our country was in shock and President Bush could have suggested any number of appropriate things, to grieve, to pray, to hope. No, he said to shop, to shop. We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing. and flow they do, guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues even, everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you gotta chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I've got a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us, you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop. So in the end, what happens to all the stuff we buy anyway? At this rate of consumption, it can't fit into our houses, even though the average house size has doubled in this country since the 1970s. It all goes out in the garbage. And that brings us to disposal. This is the part of the materials economy we all know the most because we have to haul the junk out to the curb ourselves. Each of us in the United States makes 4.5 pounds of garbage a day. That's twice what we each made 30 years ago. All of this garbage either gets dumped in a landfill, which is just a big hole in the ground, or if you're really unlucky, first it's burned in an incinerator and then dumped in the landfill. Either way, they both pollute the air, land, water, and don't forget, change the climate. Incineration is really bad. Remember those toxics back in the production stage? Well, burning the garbage releases the toxics up into the air. Even worse, it makes new super toxics, like dioxin. Dioxin is the most toxic man-made substance known to science, and incinerators are the number one source of dioxin. That means that we could stop the number one source of the most toxic man-made substance known just by stopping burning the trash. We could stop it today. Now, some companies don't want to deal with building landfills and incinerators here, so they just export the disposal, too. What about recycling? Does recycling help? Yes, recycling helps. Recycling reduces the garbage at this end, and it reduces the pressure to mine and harvest new stuff at this end. Yes, 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 we should all recycle. But recycling is not enough. Recycling will never be enough for a couple reasons. First, the waste coming out of our houses is just the tip of the iceberg. For every 1 garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that 1 garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems. Also, much of the garbage can't be recycled, either because it contains too many toxics or it's designed not to be recyclable in the first place. Like those juice packs, where they have layers of metal and paper and plastic all smooshed together, you can never separate those for true recycling. So you see, it is a system in crisis. All along the way, we are bumping up against limits. From changing climate to declining happiness, it's just not working. But the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is that there are so many points of intervention. There are people working here on saving forests and here on clean production, people working on labor rights and fair trade and conscious consuming and blocking landfills and incinerators, and very importantly, on taking back our government so that it really is by the people and for the people. All of this work is critically important, but things are really going to start moving when we see the connections, when we see the big picture. When people along this system get united, we can reclaim and transform this linear system into something new, a system that doesn't waste resources or people. Because what we really need to chuck is that old school throwaway mindset. There's a new school of thinking on this stuff, and it's based on sustainability and equity, green chemistry, zero waste, closed loop production, renewable energy, local living economies. It's already happening. Now, some say it's unrealistic. Idealistic that it can't happen. But I say the ones who are unrealistic are those that want to continue with the old path. That's dreaming. Remember, that old way didn't just happen. It's not like gravity that we've just got to live with. People created it, and we're people too. So let's create something new.
That was the audio track of The Story of Stuff, a film by Annie Leonard, which you can view online at thestoryofstuff.com.
I'm so happy to introduce Maud Baller. She's also an IFG board founding member of the IFG board and on the executive committee of the IFG. She's the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians. She's also one of the great inspiring leaders in our movement today, and co-founder of the Blue Planet Project, which works to stop commodification of the world's water. And she's a counselor on the Hamburg-based World Future Council. She's the recipient of a million awards and has received honorary doctorates from 6 Canadian universities. In addition to being nominated for 1,000 Women for the Nobel Peace Prize 2005, she's the recipient of the 2005 Lannan Cultural Freedom Fellowship and the 2005 Right Livelihood Award. She's the best-selling author or co-author of 16 books, including Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America, and Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop Corporate Theft of the World's Water with Tony Clark, now published in 47 countries. Her latest is Blue Covenant, The Global Water Crisis and the Fight for the Right to Water. And at the IFG, we spend part of our time trying to persuade her to run for Prime Minister of Canada, but so far she doesn't agree. Here's Maud Barlow.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Annie, that was just absolutely sensational, but so has the whole fabulous panel been tonight, so I'm just delighted to be here. I want to talk about the global water crisis, the freshwater crisis, but I'm going to take a couple of minutes before I do to say to a progressive American audience that we have to start talking about something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. A number of us in Canada have been doing a great deal of work on this. It's a new agreement that was signed in Waco, Texas in March 2005 by the heads of the three countries, prime ministers and presidents of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, which really was an agreement that in order post-11 for the business community, the big corporations to continue to be able to move across those borders, our three countries would adopt George Bush's war on terror and have one approach to security. Security and prosperity would go hand in hand. It is an extraordinarily dangerous agreement. It's creating a terrible and dangerous and competitive new trading bloc in the world. We've already merged our no-fly lists. We've already merged our security procedures. We are now setting up committees, cross-government committees to merge and harmonize all the regulatory regimes, whether it's environment or security or defense, no matter what, food, all of it across the country, again, based on the lowest common denominator. And when we met with the Embassy of the United States a couple of months ago, I asked them why this terrible Security and Prosperity Partnership had not been brought to the legislatures of the three countries. He told me honestly, the senior bureaucrat there told me honestly, it's because the three countries and their business community don't want another bruising NAFTA battle. They know they would lose. So this is an issue I can't go into it more tonight because I want to talk about water, but I am so determined that we are going to create, as we did with NAFTA, a continent-wide resistance to something that so far has had only perhaps some of the least pleasant folks in the United States having some concerns about it. So it's time it moved into the progressive community. On water, I have filled with fear but also hope. The research has been done, the verdict is in, and it's irrefutable, and that is that the world is facing an unprecedented freshwater crisis of such magnitude that close to 2 billion people now live in areas of the world that are severely water-stressed. What's happening is that we have three scenarios that collide towards disaster. Scenario one is that the world is running out of fresh water, which is something we were taught could never happen in the classrooms where we learned about the hydrologic cycle. But what nobody taught us, because nobody at that time understood, was that it was possible for us to massively pollute surface water so that we would then turn to overmining groundwater. And we are overmining groundwater so fast that scientists are now talking about coming anarchy, exponential anarchy. There are 25 million bore wells in India alone, pumping 24/7. This water is just being taken up, and there's no understanding of or knowledge of how much water there is and when it will run out. We're also massively displacing water, taking it from where it was put by nature, either in watersheds or groundwater, and moving it through pipelines for mass irrigation, flood irrigation, unsustainable agriculture, or moving it to huge megacities where we use it and in many cases just dump it back into the ocean, often untreated. So we're actually losing water from the hydrologic cycle. And then there's the virtual trade in water, where a country or society uses its water to produce kinds of exports that are kinds of products that are then exported out of the country. About 20% of our daily domestic use is traded away from watersheds every single day. So what we have, and I cannot stress this strongly enough, is that we are creating deserts. We are the displacement and pollution and abuse of water is the ground level equivalent of the greenhouse gas emissions from above. We hear about water being the water crisis being a result of global warming or climate change. I want us to start reversing that thinking and start to understand that what we're doing to water is actually helping to create the climate crisis. It's the ground level equivalent of what we're doing in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Scenario two is that every day thousands more in our world are living without clean water. Half of the hospital beds on Earth are now occupied with people with preventable water-borne diseases. More children are killed every day by dirty water than HIV/AIDS, malaria, accidents, and war put together. The global water crisis has become the greatest symbol of inequity in our world, and the creation and its greatest indictment of the system of market capitalism and globalization. In the next 40 years, humans will require 80% more, an 80% increase in water use. No one, absolutely no one, knows where this water is going to come from. Scenario three is just at the moment when we most need responsible governments, when we most need transparency, democracy, and responsible public oversight of this crisis. We are finding, of course, the powerful corporate water cartel has emerged to take over every aspect of water for its own profit. Corporations now deliver drinking water and take away wastewater. Corporations put massive amounts of water in plastic and sell it back to us at exorbitant prices. Corporations are building new, significant technologies to recycle our dirty water and sell it back to us as well at exorbitant prices. The whole water reuse technology industry is the fastest growing part of the water industry, which in and of itself is becoming one of the most important industries in the world, or in terms of stock markets and how much money you can make and which commodities are most profitable. Water is going to be right up there at the top very, very soon. And we have massive desalination programs run by, in many cases, nuclear power being planned. We have a new technology to suck the water out of the atmosphere, a new technology to seed clouds so that water in one community is removed from the people, by the people there before it gets to move on. We even have toilet-to-tap technology now. And I am deeply concerned with how much money particularly the American government, but also the European government, is putting into this water recycling technology, because I think it's a false solution and it's leading to a situation where we don't want to protect public water or water sources because there's so much money to be made from dirty water. Corporations also move massively water from pipelines, from watersheds and aquifers to sell it to big cities and industries. And corporations are now buying, storing, and selling water on the open market like running shoes. Most importantly, corporations now want governments to deregulate the water sector and the market to set water policy, and every day they get closer to this goal. Scenario three deepens the crisis of scenarios one and two. Imagine a world in 20 years in which no substantive progress has been made to provide basic water services in the developing world. Absolutely where we're going in terms of the UN Millennium Goals, which have failed miserably, or to create laws to protect source water and force industry and industrial agriculture production, or to stop polluting dirty water systems, or to curb the mass movement of water by pipeline, tanker, and other diversions, which are creating huge new swaths of desert. Here's what it's going to look like, I can tell you. Desalination plants will ring the world's oceans, many of them run by nuclear power. Corporate-controlled nanotechnology will clean up sewage water and sell it to private utilities, who will sell it back to us at a huge profit. The rich will drink only bottled water found in the few remote parts of the world left, or sucked from the clouds by corporate-controlled machines, while the poor die in increasing numbers. This is not science fiction. This is where the world is headed unless we change course, a moral and ecological imperative. The corporate control of water is dangerous, profoundly dangerous, in at least three ways. The first is there is now a built-in disincentive not to clean up water, not to maintain or introduce laws to protect water. There is simply huge amounts of money now to be made in recycling dirty water. The largest water corporations in the world are no longer the big bottling companies. They're no longer the big utility companies like Suez and Veolia. They're companies like General Electric, Procter & Gamble, and Dow Chemical, all into the water recycling business. In fact, telling you that toilet-to-tap recycling is good for you, and if it's just deregulated, they can get on with business. The second is that only the rich will be able to have access to water, because no transnational corporation can be competitive and successful and deliver social services at the same time. It's not their mandate. Furthermore, of course, nature will have to fend for itself in a world where corporations control water, and nature will be further plundered for the remaining pockets of blue gold, because no successful competitive transnational corporation can be in business to conserve the very product that it is peddling. Basically, what we need to do, and I'm so, one is so exciting about this IFG project and this teach-in this weekend, is that we are trying to bring these various threads together and say that no one crisis is the only crisis, and that each intertwines with the other, and that together we have to find the answers. On the water front, on the water issue, we are calling for what I call a blue covenant, which really is a covenant of three parts. We need a water conservation covenant, a covenant between people and the earth, when we have to recognize the rights of the earth and the rights of other species to water, and that we are just a species like others, and that we have to pledge to protect this. We have to have a water justice covenant. Those of us living and working in the global north must pledge to work in solidarity with people in the global south for water justice, so that there is water for all. The call for water for all needs to become a reality, and that means local control of water, and we need to work in solidarity with the global south toward that. And the third is a water democracy covenant, where we recognize that water is a fundamental right, it's a fundamental human right, and therefore governments are obliged to provide this water as a public service to their people. Corporations must abandon this field, and we absolutely have to take control back. This, then, is our task, nothing less than reclaiming water as the commons for the earth and all people that must be wisely and sustainably shared and managed if we are to survive. This will not happen unless we are prepared to reject the basic tenets of market-based globalization, the current imperatives of competition, unlimited growth, and private ownership of everything must be replaced by the imperatives of cooperation, sustainability, and public stewardship. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, says, and I think this is very, very, very wise, and I wish we would have a prime minister in my country who would think like this, "Our goals need to be to forge a real integration to live well. We say live well because we do not aspire to live better than others. We do not believe in the line of progress and unlimited development at the cost of others and nature. Live well is to think not only in terms of income per capita, but cultural identity, community, harmony between ourselves and with Mother Earth." So I end by saying that water could be our teacher. Water could be nature's gift to humanity in order to teach us how to live in harmony with the earth and peace with one another, as opposed to becoming the area of conflict, which I deeply fear is coming. In Africa, they say, we do not go to water ponds merely to capture water, but because friends and dreams are there to meet us. Thank you.
Maud Marlowe, water rights activist, author of Blue Covenant.
And we're proud to present Stuart Pym, who's the Doris Duke Professor of Conservation Ecology at the Nicholas School of Environment and Earth Science at Duke University. And he's also extraordinary professor at the Conservation Ecology Research Unit at the University of Pretoria, South Africa. He is a global expert on endangered species conservation, biodiversity, species extinction, and habitat loss. His research teams have spent many years seeking out species and ecosystems that are in the most urgent need for protection. He's the author of over 200 scientific publications, many of them in Nature and Science, and he's written 4 books, the most recent being the critically acclaimed World According to Pym, A Scientist Audits the Earth. The Institute of Scientific Information recognized him in 2002 as being one of the world's most highly cited scientists. So it's my pleasure to introduce Stuart Pym.
I want you to cast your minds back to the dark and gloomy days of last century, you know, 1999. First, there was a champagne shortage, so I went out and bought some. But then you remember there was the Y2K problem, which threatened to bring us all to our knees, and it was particularly troubling for people, men of my age, and I do mean men, who knew how to program in COBOL and Fortran and languages like that. We were all going to be carried off to some secret institution to save the world as we know it. So I decided to write a book to keep my mind off things. I wanted to do an audit of the planet from an ecologist's point of view, and that's The World According to Pym. A Scientist Audits the Earth. It's not available outside, but be consumers and buy it from Amazon.com. Because I can't wrap my mind around the extraordinary number of numbers that we've heard tonight, I just want to give you a few of them. There are 6 billion of us on the planet. About 3 billion of us on the planet live on less than a few dollars a day, which means no electricity and no antibiotics. You probably don't meet people like that, but in the places where I work, I do. And they all want to be as rich as we are, and they all want to have safe water and antibiotics. And 1 billion people around the planet want to have cars and refrigerators, and they're probably going to get them in the next 10 or 15 years. So our human impacts are high and accelerating, and they're going to increase with human population growth, and they're going to increase with, particularly with human aspirations. So what do we do to the planet? What are the salient features? What are the numbers that I can give you? And I'm afraid I'm going to give you numbers too. You have to listen to some more bloody numbers before you're allowed to go home tonight. The first thing that we do is that we take about 15 million square kilometers of the planet and convert it to cropland. That's about 130 million square kilometers of the world that's ice-free. So 15 out of 130 doesn't seem to be a lot. I'm sorry I can't speak non-metrically. If, you know, you Americans are metrically challenged, you know, sorry about that. So, in the sense, yeah, I'm accused of being British, I'm actually an American citizen, I'm very proud of it. Okay, so I still prefer a pint of beer rather than a liter of it. So, you know, 15 million square kilometers is cropland, but that leaves a lot of other places in the world. So what else are we doing to the world? Well, we are doing amazingly bad things to the world's drylands, the half 60 million square kilometers of the planet that don't have trees. Impacts upon the drylands are such that probably two-thirds of all the world's drylands are overgrazed. We overharvest the wood that's there. We beat up the soils. We overgraze the land. And Wes Jackson is going to come and give his usual brilliant and inspiring speech about how we need to go to perennial polycultures and we'll all be happy. But the final impact to land is what we're doing to the world's forests. We're shrinking the world's forests, particularly the world's tropical forests, at an extraordinary rate. Once upon a time, there was about 20 million square kilometers of tropical forest, and most of that, I mean, probably 13 million of it, has been deforested in the last 50 years or so. The rate of tropical forest deforestation is extraordinarily high, which means that deforestation is one of the leading causes of greenhouse gas emissions. Countries like Indonesia and Brazil are major greenhouse gas emitters. So, croplands, overgrazing, deforestation, that takes us care of the land. What about the fresh water? Well, most of you have probably never seen a big wild river. To go and see a big wild river, you have to go to Canada. And they have a few, like the Mackenzie, but essentially every river in the Northern Hemisphere is a river that's been dammed or channeled. And not surprisingly, the impacts upon that are that we now take 50% of the available fresh water for our use, and in doing so, we massively modify rivers, which is not good for things that live in rivers. What about the oceans? Many people have a sort of a warm, fuzzy feeling that the oceans are huge and vast and untrammeled. Well, 99% of our food that comes from the oceans comes from only 10% of them. Most of the world's oceans are simply barren deserts. They're too depauperate to support a lot of life. They're too depauperate to support fisheries. So the world's oceans are about the size of Africa. The world's productive oceans are about 30 million square kilometers. And if you look at what it takes for the productivity of those oceans to support the fisheries that we use, it's about a third or maybe 40%. So we're already massively using the world's oceans. All of those numbers are in some wildly enthusiastically, perhaps theoretical way, reversible. We could live lighter on the land, we can manage drylands better, we could chopping down forests, and we could stop over-harvesting fisheries. But species extinction is forever. We do not live in Jurassic Park. We can't bring species back after we have driven them to extinction. Now, of course, species extinctions have always been happening. That's why the dinosaurs are dead. But that doesn't mean to say that what we're experiencing now is the right rate of extinction. You have to ask, you know, how long should a species live? If you go to the Grand Canyon, the answer is that much. About a meter, that's 3 feet for you Americans. And it corresponds to about a million years. So, you know, after a million years, your time is up and you're supposed to go extinct. So another way of putting that is that one in a million species should go extinct every year. That's the sort of the background rate, the sort of happy, normal ticking over of one species after another. We can ask how fast a species is going extinct now. And the answer is it's about 100 times faster than that. And we know that for the species that we know and love the best, which are birds. You know, everybody is a bird watcher. Everybody in Britain is a bird watcher. The Birdwatching Society in Britain has a million members. It's more than any of the political parties put together, which is an aspiration that we Americans should have. But because we know so very much about birds, we know that there's about one bird extinction a year. One bird extinction out of 10,000 birds, not a million, 10,000. That's telling us that the extinction rate is 100 times faster than it should be. And if you look at how many bird species are threatened with extinction, likely to unfold over the next century or so, it's about 1,000 species. So that would mean 10 species per year on average, and that would be 1,000 times faster than we should. We are driving species to extinction 100 to 1,000 times faster than we should be, and there is no more salient feature about what miserably bad stewards we have been than that, because extinction is the irreversible process. Biodiversity is defined by the likes of Elliot North and Tom Lovejoy and Ed Wilson, is not just species. It's also genetic diversity. It's also cultural diversity if you think about human beings. And if you look at our own biological diversity, we speak at the present time about 6,500 languages. If you look at how languages manage to survive when they come across the world's leading international languages, English, Hindi, Portuguese, Spanish, Chinese, you notice I didn't say French. I have no particular desire as an Englishman to be nice to the French. If you look at how many people need to speak a language for it to survive against the onslaught of the major languages of the world, it's about 1 million people. If 1 million people speak a language, it's going to survive. It's fewer than 100,000 people. It's going to die out with a generation, within a generation. If you look at how many languages are spoken by more than 1 million people, it's about 600. We're going to lose something on the order of 90% of the world's languages within a generation. So biodiversity at all levels is under extraordinary threat. How does global warming affect things? It's going to make things worse in the worst possible way. The species that have survived the massive habitat destruction, particularly the loss of tropical forests, those species have tended to be in obscure, remote places, you know, like Canada, in the Arctic, on top of mountains. If you're a polar bear, you've had a good deal until now, and now you find that the poles are melting. So some of the remote places are now under threat. So we've destroyed the easy places, but even the remote places are now getting it. Vast numbers of species living on tops of mountains in the tropics have nowhere else to go when the climate warms because, you know, God hasn't made the mountains any higher than they are. So global warming is an added threat. And probably from the calculations that colleagues and I have done, that the extinction rate caused by global warming is going to be at least as high as the extinction rate caused from all the habitats that we have destroyed. Can we do anything about these things? Well, we haven't heard much about solutions tonight, and I'm going to give you a very simple one. I think there's a lot we can do to fix global warming and the loss of biological diversity, and we can do it easily and we can do it cheaply, which is probably not the answer that you expected to hear coming to a meeting like this one today. Something like 5 million square kilometers of tropical forests have been cleared within the last 50 or 60 years and are not croplands. These are wretched, miserable cattle pastures with scrawny cattle. And they occur around the world's tropics. If you go to a cattle pasture in Brazil or Hawaii or northern Australia or Africa, they are filled with the same scrawny cattle and the same unpleasant weeds, lantana and scraggly eucalyptus trees and the rest of it. What would happen if we were to put a fence around those 5 million square kilometers of bad pasture land? We would suddenly start soaking up 5 gigatons of carbon. A gigaton is 1 billion tons. So I want you to start thinking of billions and billions of tons and remembering the late Carl Sagan. The Earth has the capacity to soak up an enormous amount of carbon. And in doing so, it would take care of global warming, at least for a bit. More importantly, it would take care of the biodiversity crisis too. That there are remarkably special places around the world where the wild things are, where the greatest concentrations of threatened species are to be found. Places like Madagascar, places like the Atlantic coast forest of Brazil, the Andes, Southeast Asia. Places like that hold the greatest variety of life that is at risk of extinction. These are the places where the extinctions are happening. If we were to buy up the land there, we would take care of a big piece of the global carbon emissions problem. Not all of it. I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't drive around on your bicycles since a Prius is no longer acceptable. I'm not trying to tell you that you shouldn't walk home tonight to feel good about it. But on the other hand, we can buy up a lot of carbon and we can make a big difference to global carbon emissions. Naturally, there is a website you can go to do all this. It's mine. It's called www.savingspecies.org. And I want you to go there and I want you to buy some carbon, because if you buy carbon, you will feel good about yourselves and you will have expunged your carbon sin. And importantly, you will save biodiversity too. Sir Richard Branson, has a $25 million reward for a good idea for soaking up carbon. Sir Richard, it's called a tree. There are things that we can do. Thank you. There are things that we can do. There are solutions. I don't want you to go home tonight and throw yourself in the river because it's polluted and you'll get terribly ill. There are things that we can do to save the planet, and let's spend the next couple of days thinking about them. Thank you very much indeed.
That was conservation ecologist Stuart Pym of Duke University speaking at the IFG teach-in, Confronting the Global Triple Crisis, held last September in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Next, we'll hear some highlights from audience questions with panelists Jerry Mander, Simon Retallick, David Corton, Maud Barlow, Annie Leonard, and Stuart Pym. The audience members' audio was not very loud, so excuse the scratchy quality.
Welcome to the post-panel panel. And we're just here to answer anybody's questions. We'll just open up for anybody who wants to ask or comment or whatever you want.
I'm an industrial hygienist, so my scientific abilities to sift through the studies are somewhat challenging. Then I look at my father, who's a high school history teacher, reasonably intelligent man, but not exposed to this kind of stuff very much. So your statement that there's consensus now on global climate change is probably true among those of you that have been tracking global climate change for your livelihood and is your passion. You know, I had an out loud, embarrassing argument with my father in a restaurant because he started quoting something either from Rush Limbaugh or Fox News. That message is not on the playground where I take my kids to play. It's not with my father at home. It's not even with the American Industrial Hygiene Association.
Well, you know, we begin with events like this, and there are lots of good books, and you start where you are. You know, you start putting it out from the sources that you have. And you try to build a momentum for it. There's no magic bullet for how to get it out. I think the magic bullet's going to come when you get enough hurricanes and storms and melting ice caps and islands disappearing. And when it begins to hit people personally, then it'll be a very, very clear message to them. But until then, it's up to us to send out the early warnings. Anybody want to add on to that?
Yes.
Maud?
I also think it's important to remember that there are people in other parts of the world who are living a very different reality than those of us living in North America or Europe, and they are much more aware, they're much more in tune with how environment, human rights, and their own loss of power and sovereignty and livelihood is connected. So I find, for instance, in the water movement, you don't have to explain any of this. If you go to the Global South, they're living it. 2 billion people don't have access to clean water, and that's the first face of climate change.